After World War II, when radio began to give way to a new medium called television, the New York Times responded by assigning its radio writer to cover TV on a regular basis. That writer was Jack Gould, who became one of the first and most influential TV critics at a time when the medium was fresh and experimental. He reviewed Howdy Doody, I Love Lucy, Marty, and See It Now. He also wrote essays about TV's big issues of the day, from the quiz show scandals and blacklisting to the increasing popularity and impact of television itself. Gould covered TV for the Times from 1947 until 1972 and died in 1993. His son Louis L. Gould, a professor of American history at the University of Texas at Austin, sifted through thousands of his father's reviews and essays and published a book collecting 70 of his father's most historical, original, and passionate columns. The book is called Watching Television Come of Age, The New York Times Reviews by Jack Gould. Lou Gould provides historical context for each entry, and some personal context as well. In 1947, when Jack Gould began reviewing television, he moved his family to Stamford, Connecticut, and began working from home. I spoke with Lou Gould last year when the book first came out in paperback.
Well, he believed that he should see television, which was mostly live in those days, except for, you know, the old movies and things, that he should see it the way people at home saw it. And this imposed on him severe deadlines because the Times had to put the paper to bed by, I guess, 11:30 at night. So when the programs ended at 11, he had about 15 to 17 minutes to write a 300-word review. It was a gut-wrenching experience for him, but he learned how to do it, and then he would call them up and dictate his piece over the phone to the city desk, and it would appear the next day.
Well, take us into the Gould living room or the TV room back then. When he started, you would have been, what, eight, seven? How old?
Yeah, I really am not too familiar with it until I was in my early teens, which would be in the early 50s. He didn't like much in the way of disturbances, and young boys tended to be more disturbing than encouraging. And there's some, if you read some of the pieces where he talks about us bouncing on the sofas and otherwise distracting him, you'll get a sense of how we could drive him crazy. But by the early 50s, as we got to be more mature in our early teens, I at least, he would ask us in the watch, and we could sit there as long as we didn't say anything. And then when he was done, he would say, "That's it," and that was our cue to get out of the room, and the typewriter would start away. By the time I got to college, I could sit in the room and watch him type and still not say anything, and then sometimes he would let us read the pieces and see what we thought of them. It was an awe-inspiring experience. I can remember one occasion when we were watching one of the televised national political conventions, and Huntley and Brinkley were on a set where they were very close together. And he said, "It looks like those guys are playing kneesies out there." And the phone rang, and it was somebody from NBC. And he said, "By the way, are Chet and David playing kneesies out there?" And about 5 minutes later, over the air, Huntley and Brinkley said, "Someone in the East says we may be playing kneesies out here." And I thought, that is amazing stuff.
That is amazing.
But most of the time, he didn't, you know, get involved in the actual program, but just watched.
It is interesting when you read the columns 50 years later, and he's writing about Lucille Ball. He's writing about Rod Serling. He's writing about Patty Chayefsky. And now these people are Lucille Ball, you know, Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling. They're icons. But back then, they were just other, you know, performers, writers, and you're seeing icons being shaped. And go ahead. I just wonder.
Well, but this was what was on Tuesday, and he would go in there and sit down, and you didn't. Part of the excitement of it was that you might have a Marty or a Patterns. Now, sometimes you had a clinker and a dud, but when those magical moments came with a play that, like the Julius Caesar or Patterns or the Days of Wine and Roses, there was an immediacy and a power about it that, whatever the technical quality of television now, and it's impressive, I don't think it has that same sense that it was an event, and that the next day when you went to school or talked to people they would say, did you see that last night? And that sense of a shared experience of people in the late 40s and early 50s is something, I guess, except for, you know, cable or some news broadcast now, there's not that sense of excitement.
Did your father's tastes strike you as odd in any respect in looking over these things?
Well, his tastes in culture generally tended to be pretty congruent with mine. I suppose that's normal for growing up with somebody, though I was more interested in modern jazz than he was. I had not realized how much he was involved as a young reporter with the nightclub scene in New York, jazz, and the swing era. He wrote a terrific article about Count Basie and how black bands at that time were discriminated against by white booking agents, which I was quite surprised to find, gratified but surprised. But he had a kind of New York theatrical kind of sensibility. As I say in the book, he thought Rodgers and Hart were terrific and was less impressed with Rodgers and Hammerstein, which is a continuing debate in that area. Not having gone to college, he was somewhat sensitive about his intellectual credentials and defensive in some instances on that. But he seemed to be a very well-read and interesting man in the way that he dealt with opera, shows like Omnibus, and things where there was a range of artistic development involved. So I came to have a great deal of respect. He was obviously reading more than I thought as a child when he seemed to be, too busy to talk to me.
Was it his passion for the moral issues that had him write so many columns, or at least so many that you collected in the book, about blacklisting, about the quiz show scandals?
Well, of course, as you know, reporters tend to have a deep well of cynicism about human nature, but there's also a vein of idealism in the best of them. And he was, I think it's fair to say, I mean, allowing for prejudice, a very moral man in his view of what the networks and television should be. And he had a sense of fair play. And I think the biggest reason he was outraged by blacklisting and the quiz show scandals is that the networks had really betrayed the faith of their audience. And that, he, I think, believed was unforgivable. That it was they had the power, they had the influence over society, and it was up to them to play fair and to do the right thing. And so in some ways, now a naive and innocent view, but I must say, reading back on it, I found it as attractive now as I did at the time.
Lou, I think the next thing I'd like to ask you to do is to pick your own favorite passage from the book and maybe okay. Read a paragraph from it. If there's something that you can single out that as a son, as an historian, for whatever reason, that you're especially proud of being able to disseminate in this new form.
I think the thing that impressed me was the See It Now column from 1951, November 19, 1951, where he talks about Murrow and his trip to Korea. And they have a documentary film made in Korea, and it talks about the soldiers on the front. And when we think about North Korea and the axis of evil and the problems that we have today, it makes you realize how short history is and how much we're still living with the results of the 1950s.
Well, go ahead and read it for us, please.
The last half of the program was devoted to a documentary film that CBS had taken in Korea. It showed all the hardship, good humor, and tension of the average soldier's existence at the front. The film was tough and real, but always thoughtful. And Mr. Murrow's sparing comments cut to the viewer's heart. When the film showed the GIs digging their foxholes, he remarked, "If you dig before dark, you have a better chance of living until light." Then came the climax. One by one, the soldiers stepped before the camera and merely gave their name and hometown. Mr. Murrow reported on what had happened to the company since the film was made. 50 casualties. With searching eyes, Mr. Murrow looked straight at the camera and said that some of the wounded might need blood. "Can you spare a pint?" he asked. To television, in short, finally has come Mr. Murrow's rare feeling for the value of understatement in reporting the news and telling the facts as they are. Those qualities obviously were a source of inspiration for all who contributed to the success of See It Now, and more important to the persons privileged to watch their efforts. Television had a taste of its true glory yesterday. I can't read that. Every time I read that, I choke up a little bit. I remember seeing the program, but it just seemed to me that was Dad at the top of his form. And Murrow, too.
Now, he was a television critic. We've been focusing on the early years of television because that's just so fascinating to me anyway, for him to start in 1947 as a television critic. But he actually didn't retire as a TV critic until 1972. So he had a large body of work. What was your sense of him in the later decades in terms of his relationship with television?
I think he became progressively more disillusioned. He would say that he was written out, that he'd spent 20 years glued to the tube, that he was repeating himself, that he had nothing new to say. And I think some of that was true. It was a high-tension job that wore him out physically and emotionally. But I also think that by the mid-60s, he had the sense that whatever the promise of television had been 15 years earlier, it was not to be realized or didn't seem to be realized. And after the Newton Minow episode in the early 60s with the Kennedy administration and the vast wasteland issues. that was not going to change, I think he became convinced that repetition and money-making and the high ratings were going to dominate, and that television, while it would have its moments, was not something to which he wanted to devote the rest of his life. And I think it was time. He was only a man in his late 50s by the time he retired, but he had said most of what he wanted to say and most of what he could say. And there was an arc to his career that told him that it was time to move on, and it was clear that it was.
American history professor Lew Gould, editor of a book of influential TV reviews and essays by his late father, Jack Gould. The book is called Watching Television Come of Age.